Welcome to Unobscured, a production of iHeartRadio and Aaron Menke.
Our guest historian today is Nancy Rubin Stewart. She's an award-winning author and journalist whose biographies dig deep into the lives of women who were power players during pivotal moments in American history. Storytelling is her life's work. She's the executive director of the Cape Cod Writers Center in Massachusetts, and she's co-president of the Boston chapter of the National Book Association. Researcher Carl Nellis talked with Nancy about her book on Maggie Fox, The Reluctant Spiritualist, which retells Maggie's life in dramatic detail. About halfway through the conversation, a storm rose up around the studio and forced us to make some changes to the recording setup. It made us wonder whether Maggie was 100% pleased with the project, but I think that you'll want to hear Nancy's side of the story anyway. So we begin with Nancy's perspective on what it took to be a spiritualist in the 19th century. This is the Unobscured Interview Series for Season 2. I'm Aaron Menke.
To be a spiritualist in the 19th century, I think would take quite a bit of pluck and bravery. Depends on where you are, because you would either be revered, adored, admired, or you would be despised and connected with all the evil things in the world and all of the fears in religion about communion with the devil.
So what were the motivations then? So you say it would take pluck and bravery, and that's so clear in the lives of the people who were involved. But what would motivate someone to become a medium or to go to a seance?
Well, to become a medium, the movement itself had huge resonance through society. You have to understand that in the 19th century, especially in the early years and up to the Civil War, there was great religious ferment and change. It started with the Second Great Awakening, which was sort of a refutation in a way of many of the Enlightenment ideas of reason and logic. And so the Second Great Awakening looked at really evolves from Romanticism, English Romanticism, where, that there's emotion and that human beings... there's something magical and mysterious about us. And so there's a revival at that point of different and really transformation of many different religious ideas, so that you have new sects forming, you have revival meetings, you have camp meetings, you have charismatic preachers, and you have questioning of the old Calvinistic ideas that man was imbued with original sin and he must suffer, and if he didn't live a certain kind of a life, he would burn in hellfire. All of this, with the changes that are going on around it in 19th century American industrialism, cities, urbanization, and so on, made people think that there were other ways to be a good person and other ways to embrace the world. And so brotherhood and abolition and coeducation and all of these themes start to come in. So questions about religion, the old religion, and then questions about the afterlife prevail. And so there's sort of, as I say, a breakdown of the old, very old values and a look at, well, maybe death, which by the way was, the life expectancy was short for children, for women and for men. I mean, in Massachusetts, for instance, the life expectancy for a man was 50, for a woman, this is average, was 42. So death is all around us every moment. So what is death? Is it to be feared? Are we to burn in hellfire for our sins? Or is death something that is benevolent and kind and, infects all of us and that therefore we shouldn't fear it? So given that as a long background, so spiritualism becomes the idea that one can commune with, that the human being is not just a body, just a logical, rational, set of tissues and cells and whatnot, but is rather, there's something higher, there's a spirit. And that spirit cannot be quelled or die with the body's death. And so spiritualism is a communion with the spirits of those who have gone, and a happy communion in general, a positive one.
Mm. So another kind of big picture question, but that reframes the conversation just a bit, is how significant is spiritualism as a chapter in American history, particularly for women, in American, maybe in American women's history?
Well, it's extremely significant for women. I'll come back to that in a moment, but it's also, I would say that it is a conduit for many things that are today greatly transformed from that, because it encompasses many different social movements. It encompasses early psychology. It encompasses early political means of, looking to get rid of slavery. It has a whole, besides what we know about today, when we think about spiritualism, and I'm talking now in the vernacular, psychics and crystals and all the previous New Age that went on in the 1990s and so on, all of that really goes back to what happened with spiritualism and this whole resurgence of this idea of communing with spirits. So it's a very important movement, which we just really don't even think that much about today, except in certain circles. But as to women, it's very important because women were very much involved in the very early days with the pro-social movements of abolition in particular, and brotherhood, and obviously the beginnings of women's rights, where you want to have equal rights for everybody, that all souls are equal. I mean, we get into that whole aspect of religion, which I'll come back to later, but where all souls are equal, therefore all people, in a way, all people of all colors and races and creeds are equal. And so abolition, which is sort of the driving force, people like William Lloyd Garrison, for instance, was a spiritualist. So there's a belief that spirits all spirits should be respected. And therefore, so women in their early, very early women's rights, many of those people actually sat at some of the very early seance tables. In fact, it's been said that some of the early founders, by the way, people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, for instance, there are others too, the McClintocks, and some of the others, the very early ones, those tables, this is all blended in the very early days, before the 1848 Seneca Falls Convention.
Before we dive into the life of Maggie Fox, the people that she knew, the events she was a part of, I wanted to ask one more question kind of about your work and your perspective, because in addition to writing a biography of Maggie Fox, you've also written historical biographies of Marjorie Meriwether Post and Mercy Otis Warren and Isabel of Castile. And it made me wonder if there's a common thread between the women that you've chosen to write these long book-length studies about.
Yes, there is. Not that it was ever, I guess, in the beginning, intentional. The first biography, I'd written other journalistic books before that on social trends and women, but the first biography I wrote was on Isabella of Castile, Queen Isabella. But you've mentioned the other books, so I won't belabor that. But more importantly, I was curious, and this is going way back, earlier, that what about women in power? And what happened to the women in power much earlier than our time? I mean, right now we're hearing a great deal about this again, and particularly with what's gone on with the Me Too movement. But what happened to women who had power? There were women occasionally in history who had power. And what happened to those who didn't have power and why? So my biographies all reflect that. That's the link.
Mm-hmm. So let's step back into the 1840s.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that it's this period of religious ferment. And some of what we're seeing in that history is some young traditions, some young denominations are starting to grow in power and conflict with each other, Methodists, Universalists, there are Shaker communities. And you mentioned the revivalist kind of practices of camp meetings and circuit preaching and that kind of thing. How did this kind of religious atmosphere open space for spiritualism in particular? And which traditions in this ferment were the strongest influences on spiritualism's origin?
Well, I think it's a mix. It was what we'd call the zeitgeist of the time, the flavor of the time, what was sort of in the air, what was being discussed, because all of this was being discussed and experienced in upstate New York in particular, which, by the way, was a very prosperous area because the Erie Canal had opened, and so all the produce and all the furs and all kinds of other things that were coming from the north could now come down through the canal into the Hudson and down to New York City. So places like Rochester, New York, which is near where the spiritualism, the official start of American spiritualism supposedly begins, and I'll explain that in a minute, supposedly because there's a lot of other threads that feed into that. So Rochester, New York is a very sophisticated, at that point, area. It's a city, and it's prospering, and it has filled with ideas, and people have come in because, again, it's one of the conduits for the Erie Canal, and it's in its own way, quite sophisticated in terms of ideas. But as it turns out, also, Rochester's in the middle of what was then in Western New York, and all of the sort of the leading new religions, the Millerites, who had predicted the end of the world, which eventually becomes the Seventh-day Adventists. The Shakers had come from England. The Shakers were a branch of the Quakers, but they were called Shakers because they shook during their religious ecstasy pronouncements. So the Shakers come from England, but they also are settling in upstate New York. And of course, the Mormons, the Book of Moroni and Joseph Smith all start in upstate New York. So this enormous religious ferment. And out of that religious ferment, by the way, also comes a skepticism eventually, because there's so much of it. In fact, it's been called Western New York at that time, the burnt out area, that people were really burnt out with all of these camp meetings and these different religious expressions and meetings and so on. And so there's a sort of a quest for a return to the simplicity. And, you know, not that spiritualism is simple, but the idea of it is that, again, we'll come back to the all souls and the pushes. Underground Railroad is really important in upstate New York. Many, many women in particular are helping, but men too are helping slaves escape so they can escape up to Canada and be free. So in all of that, this idea comes out. Now, there's a man called Andrew Jackson Davis. And Andrew Jackson Davis had based his ideas on this idea of communion with the spirits, with an earlier European philosopher, Swedenborg. So Swedenborgism and Andrew Jackson, he then promotes a book just before the Fox sisters sort of begin. And they know nothing about, the girls know nothing about it, but he promotes the idea of spirit communication again, and that one can communicate with spirits. Spirit communication is ancient. It's probably as old as mankind. I mean, it goes way back into the Greek philosophers. It's in many Asian religions. The Native Americans continue to worship spirits. So this is not new, but he's given it kind of a new twist. That is the background for how this book, The Divine Revelations of Nature, comes out as a best-selling book, and it sweeps the country. And one of the people who reads it is none other than the girl's older sister, Leia Fox Fish. But the girls don't know anything about this. They begin spiritualism in such a humble way. By first trying to play tricks on their mother, that their little farmhouse, which is in, it's about 30 miles from Rochester, is haunted. I mean, it begins in such an incredibly folksy, homey way, and that's part of its appeal. And they, Maggie Fox, the heroine of my, or the main character of my book, is 15 and her sister Katie is 12. I mean, they know nothing about the other part. It's just fantastic coincidence that really ignites the beginning of spiritualism.
Mm. And can you describe in brief what it is that they do that kicks this whole thing off?
Sure. Well, the mother is very superstitious. The girls had come, the whole family had come from Rochester. So you have this 15-year-old bored Maggie Fox. She wants to be back in Rochester. She's a teenager, obviously. And Katie, a little sister, who will follow her. And their mother is so superstitious, and they live in this old farmhouse, and they start thinking about, well, who lived there before? People lived here before? Did people die here before? And then they decide they're going to play jokes on their mother. And so at first, they're doing all kinds of things somehow or other. And I've tried this. It doesn't work for me. They have tried to make sounds with their toes, popping their toes, popping their ankles, and so on, to make these raps, these ghostly raps that would occur at night. And then to sort of hype this up, I mean, they keep practicing it. They have a cousin, actually, Leah's daughter, their older sister's daughter, who was with them at first. And then to kind of rev this up, they tie strings on apples and they mimic footsteps in the middle of the night and scare their mother. So that's really how it begins. And she becomes convinced. And then they go too far with it. Their mother becomes so convinced that they continue with it. They're thrilled by it. And then they say they think there's a spirit they can communicate with, and they talk to it. And then one will talk to it, and the other one will make quietly raps with her feet. And pretty soon, Mrs. Fox becomes so excited and hysterical that she invites in the neighbors, and now they're caught. So they continue on with these seances. And, of course, the church, the local Methodist Episcopal Church, is not too happy with them. But anyway, this becomes a crowd, a sensation, and people start coming from all over. And there's a man who I guess would be an investigative reporter today who starts writing about them and visiting them, and it gets promoted in newspapers in Rochester. And it really becomes quite a sensation. And meanwhile, Leah, their oldest sister, who is a single mother at this point and a piano teacher in Rochester, who's read the Andrew Jackson Davis book and knows of all these ideas that are going on. I mean, she's a piano teacher to the wealthy in Rochester. She comes to find out what is going on with this seance. By now, there are crowds of people, the people lining up. The whole Fox household cannot function. They can't control these seances. And every night they do these seances. And Mrs. Fox sort of announces them. And the girls are caught in this terrible sort of a lie, but they can't, you know, they're going to be disgraced. Their parents will be disgraced if they refute it. And Leah needs money. And she's quite a promoter. She's really a very good PR person. She brings them to Rochester and she has them, she forces them. She sort of blackmails them, actually. She's not the kindest person. And she blackmails them that she's going to expose them if they don't continue these seances. And then she tries to learn how to do these movements with their toes. But she's older. She's in her 30s. She can't move her feet the way they did. So she depends on them for that. And, of course, eventually, as this newspaper hubbub continues, it ends up that it reaches. I mean, there are people like Horace Greeley in the New York Tribune and others, but he in particular, who gets wind of it, he sends up a reporter to witness it. They attend all these seances. You know, there's a lot of funny stories and strange stories. One can make the argument that these girls, through Leah, would know about the people whose families, loved ones had died, and so they learned a lot of information. And when they sit in a darkened room and hold hands and sort of do a religious ceremony, you know, blessing everyone with peace and contentment, that they're going to reach one of these deceased people. And then suddenly the raps come, and then either Leah interprets them as to what it's about and relates intimate details about this beloved one's, lost one's life. People are amazed and believe it. But, you know, there are many accounts, not just then, but later on, where you really have to wonder whether they develop a clairvoyance, because some of them are inexplicable, and it's threaded throughout the book, but there are those other incidents. But anyway, it finally gets to be so big. And meanwhile, the church is, of course, horrified. They think these girls are witches. They are communing with something they shouldn't be, communing with the dead. So that they're, you know, again, as I said earlier, there are death threats against them, and they have to be, you know, very careful where they go. And some very religious clergy and people in Rochester threaten to kill them or run them out of town or tar and feather them at the least. Anyway, they end up in November of 48, they end up on a huge stage in Corinthian Hall, which is a grand hall in Rochester at that time. And they give a seance, but the raps are just very vaguely heard. I mean, it's obviously a rather large auditorium. The press is there. One of Horace Greeley's reporters there from New York. There are other reporters there, and from the Rochester papers and elsewhere in upstate New York. And so there's an outcry. Are they frauds? Are they hoaxes? What's happening? And there's a committee appointed to examine the girls, particularly Leah and Maggie at this point, to find out if they're making these sounds with their body, that they must be. So these examinations go on for 4 or 5 days, several of them, because it's an age of modesty for women, with women, you know, having them be basically undressed down to their underwear and examining them. And there's all kinds of prominent people who are now believers, everything from, you know, city officials to judges and even senators, because they have had the opportunity to be in a seance and communicate with a loved one. And most of the time, the messages, by the way, are reassuring to the people who are still grieving. So that goes on for 5 days with these examinations, but nothing is determined. And the publicity on this spreads as they continue to do these seances, which, by the way, Leah is pocketing most of the money. Which Maggie, in one of her books later on, The Missing Link to Spiritualism, you know, later, much later in life, bitterly describes. But anyway, it grows. The movement grows. And within a year or two, I mean, they're nationally known. There are child mediums springing up in other places. There are spirit circles that are now in 7 or 8 cities across America. You know, from Philadelphia to San Francisco, people become believers. There are new mediums. I mean, the idea for a medium was you had a pretty untainted spirit that you could commune with yourself. You were a living person who had, you know, you were innocent. You were able to receive these perceptions and these messages. So there are many, many child mediums, and then, of course, in particular, women mediums, because they were so much more protected from, quotes, the real hustle-bustle male world in the 19th century. And eventually, they get to New York, mm-hmm. where Horace Greeley, again, is kind of watching them and promoting them and being kind to them and meeting them. And they're staying in, you know, wonderful hotels. They're Broadway. There's a Broadway song written about them. There are dolls that are made replica. It became a rage all over. So now you have these country girls who are been brought up into this entire venue, this whole way of thinking about people and learning about them and trying to interpret what the spirits are saying when there are these seances. It's an incredible movement. By 1854, there are 15,000 petitions signed in a petition by some very prominent senators and judges and so on. And it's brought to Congress because now it's become this outrage. I mean, the religions are all up in the air about the standard religions. Mm. But, you know, there's a funny discussion that goes on about how to do this in Congress, but ultimately it's tabled for the moment. But I just want to mention that because it just shows you the the enormity, the popularity of it, and the fantastic publicity that surrounded this early movement.
Mm. And you mentioned that some of that publicity is positive, and they make friends among the press, like Horace Greeley. At the same time, some of the doubts, right, that started at the very beginning, like you mentioned, continue on. After that first investigation in 1848, there's also an 1851 investigation where they bring in Buffalo University faculty. And they have a relative, Mrs. Culver, who publishes an account saying that Maggie admitted to her how they made the raps and the fact that they were staged and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
What effect did these kind of personal pushbacks or the constant scrutiny have on Maggie Fox, say, in particular?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, she, at least in the beginning, does not love this. She's kind of roped into it. She's kind of caught in it. She's really more in the beginning, more the one who does it more than Katie. Katie learns. Katie seems to become quite clairvoyant. But Maggie, at times, has gone on strike with her sister, Leia, because she resents the fact that Leia is so overbearing and grasping, and she seems to keep all the money to herself. And while they live well and they're, you know, they probably have bodyguards, dress well, and they're celebrities, she's just not completely pleased with it. You know, I just want to say there are distinguished people who all sort of weigh in on this, besides doctors and senators and Congress and so on. There are distinguished writers and thinkers who also weigh in on this. People like Ralph Waldo Emerson, who, while transcendentalism is his pet philosophy, transcendentalism meaning that this world is only a shadow, what this physical world is only a shadow of a larger spiritual one. I mean, again, this is part of the whole aura of the time. But you know, he becomes disgusted, and he calls it a rat revelation, that the gospel that comes in by raps in the wall and bumps in the table drawer. And James Russell Lowett, the poet, condemns it, and Henry David Thoreau says that he thinks people who believed it were idiots inspired by the crackling of a restless board. And yet there are famous professors Professor Emeritus of University of Pennsylvania chemist, Robert Hare, who becomes a believer. So Maggie at times has rebelled, and this has not worked too well. And she's, again, caught up in this whole kind of a whirlwind of publicity and fame and celebrityhood and attention and so on. But I'll call her the reluctant spiritualist because she's kind of forced into keep doing this. And she has at least a sensitivity to people and maybe some clairvoyance. It would seem that way from some of the later reports. In my book, I really don't judge who I tell the story because I'm a storyteller. But I don't judge whether, I mean, there are clairvoyants. There are people who work for the police department today and other things that have happened, that there are occasionally people who, you know, who seem to be able to predict or understand something that isn't obvious to the rest of us. So Maggie has become, by now she's 18, 19, and Leia wants to spread out the people who do the seances. Katie is already 15 or 16, so she's got Katie in New York to work with her. And they do tours really all over by railroad. But Katie is now a beautiful young woman also. They're both very good looking, which certainly helps have both men and women admire them in the seance circle and be close to these celebrities. But Maggie finally goes to the Webb Hotel in Philadelphia, and she gives seances there. I'm going to stop there because that starts her whole other story.
Right, but, and I want to jump to that in just a minute. But there's an episode. There's a kind of dramatic episode in Troy, New York, as well for Maggie, right before she gets to Philadelphia. Do you remember the details of that?
She is remarkable. Is all I can say. It's very strange. But again, there are terrible death threats that are made for them, towards them, And so it is with Maggie, and she just doesn't want to go on. I mean, she's kind of a nervous character. Well, you can understand why. Mm-hmm. She's kind of nervous, and she just doesn't want to go on. But she's caught up in this, forced to go on. It's too late to refute it. It's too many now thousands of people and too many things that have happened. And so she must continue.
Well, then let's jump to Philadelphia and that other part of her life that opens up when she meets Elisha Kane.
Yeah, Elisha Kent Kane was from an elite Philadelphia family. His father was a judge, and his mother, was from a very well-to-do Philadelphia family, and they're very distinguished, upstanding citizens. And Elisha Kent Kane is a physician, but he's also an explorer. He has rheumatic fever. So I remember his father said to him, well, your life may be short, but make it really useful. And Elisha, knowing he had rheumatic fever, which was fairly common in those days, did exactly what his father said. Besides being a physician, he wanted to learn more about the world, and he wanted to help people in other ways. And one of the things that intrigued him was the disappearance of Sir John Franklin, who was a British explorer, who went to the Arctic with a crew of men, and they disappeared, and nobody could find them. And he was determined that he could. And so he went with his own crew of people on the Resolute, and he went to the Arctic. Had already been to the Arctic once, and not funded enough, even though major universities and major funders, including, I believe, part of the Smithsonian, the early Smithsonian, had helped fund that expedition. Well, he came back, and in 1852, I don't know why, but I think he was intrigued. He's intrigued with everything. He's intrigued with ideas. He decides he's going to investigate, and he's extremely dubious. Being a physician, he's been dubious about the reality of this seance. So he goes to a seance with Maggie Fox.
Both Maggie and Katie were very beautiful young women, so that certainly did help in terms of people being popular and amazed. And, this was a time when women didn't speak out in public and were doing that. And so were mediums around the country now for the first time. So it was pretty interesting. But anyway, Maggie, so it was 1852. It's Webb's Hotel in Philadelphia. She's there by herself doing seances, and he appears, and he's dubious. But that he comes back again a few more times, and of course they have discussions, and he becomes intrigued, and pretty soon they're in love. And this is not going to go too well with Leia, because Leia wants to keep Maggie as sort of a cash cow. She certainly doesn't want her getting involved with somebody like him. And he's, as I say, from this really elite family. His father's a district judge. His mother is an important society matron in Philadelphia. They're a distinguished couple, and they have a very politically prominent family in Philadelphia. Nevertheless, he continues to court her, and when Maggie goes back to New York, there's all kinds of scenes. There are many different episodes that happen, and she does have to go to Washington, D.C., where again, she's, doing seances for very, very prominent people and senators and so on. And he wants to marry her. And there are bitter fights with Leia. And this is going to really, and moreover, he wants to make her into his wife. Well, she's not going to be a medium, which was considered at that time. Again, there's a great deal of skepticism. Who are these people? They're like actors. They're fraudists. Actors and actresses weren't considered among the highest level, no matter how gifted, in the middle of 19th century America. And this great disdain and contempt for these people, and they're roguish. So this is not going to happen, but he has an idea that he's going to turn Maggie into, quotes, a lady. And he'll do so by sending her, he'll educate her. She, of course, had not had much education from the time she was about 15, once they started to become popular. So she agrees to marry him, and there's an enormous breach with Leia and even with Katie, because Katie is now sort of the main spiritualist along with Leia. But Maggie is, you know, Maggie is madly in love with him and he with her. So he is about to take yet another expedition to the Arctic. And before he does, he sets Maggie up in a school. Actually, it's in a place called Crookville, Pennsylvania, which always amuses me. But it's with a woman who is a teacher, and it's all actually I think it's a private situation. And she lives there, and the woman sort of makes sure she isn't doing anything improper, and she's keeping her, you know, making her study all the time. This is not good for Maggie, and she's out in the country. She's bored out of her, just bored to tears. And she returns a few times to New York City. Meanwhile, on May 31st, 1853, Elisha Kane departs with a crew, and he's funded by the Smithsonian and all kinds of other people. And there's fanfare. There's a huge salutes. He's not a member of the, he's not, you know, part of the Navy, but there's Navy escorts and so on, and newspapers and so on, and off he goes to the Arctic again. And Maggie is stuck with this woman, Mrs. Turner, in Crookville, and keeps coming back to New York. And he is gone for, he's actually gone for over 2 years. And she waits for him, not happily. She actually sends letters to Greenland several times. A few times, there's a couple of uncanny things where she senses he's in danger, even though she isn't hearing from him. And indeed, he is. Actually, the ship gets frozen in the ice, which is disastrous for the crew. And through all kinds of heroics, he walks hundreds of miles in this freezing cold and learns how to reach other people. And some of the crew now begin to work and live with the Native Americans, the Eskimos up there. Some of the stories are pretty grim. He's also an artist, which is fascinating, because there's a great book that he does later, in which there are wonderful drawings of what the Arctic looked like then. It's pretty ferocious. Anyway, he finally comes back. And the odd thing is, living in cold, cold air, yes, away from the impurities of whatever, chimney smoke and whatever, his rheumatic fever is, he's much better. He's stronger. He looks great. And then she waits for him, and she hears about his arrival, of course, and she's waiting and waiting, and he doesn't come, and she becomes hysterical. Finally, 2 days later, he comes to her sheepishly, and she's at that point in New York and living in her mother's home. Her mother's home, by the way, it's Horace Greeley's home. It's his townhouse, but he lives in the country then. And she's actually living with her tutor, her other person, the Kane. A family had helped a friend who was trying to look after her. And mm-hmm. He comes to her, and she's so happy to see him, and she can't understand why he didn't come and see her right away, and she's waited 2 years. And he says to her, Maggie, I can't marry you. And, you know, she's given up spiritualism. She's alienated most of her family. She has no income. He had funded her up until now. Why can't you marry me? Because I can't approve of you, a rapper, which is what they called them, and I can't marry you. And she of course, becomes hysterical. She's just not considered good enough for him. And she says, well, you know, you say you love me no matter what. And he says, well, yeah, but my family says they're going to disown me if I marry you. So there are months and months of all kinds of attempts to get back together again and so on. and break off. And meanwhile, Leia, of course, and Katie, I mean, there's a lot of tension with the Fox family and even Mrs. Fox, because this is something they'd signed on and spent now quite a few years invested in and were known for that. Finally, he's back from the Arctic. He's a hero. He's writing a book about this last trip. He did not, by the way, find Sir John Franklin and his crew. That is somewhat later that they find the remains of those people. But that's another story. Excuse me. So he's supposed to go to England to be honored by the Royal Society and to have a reception all Whitehall and all kinds of other dignitaries, because it's fantastic that he did this. And his health is failing, but he's going to go anyway. And a few nights before he leaves, he suggests to her that they get married. But he can't marry her in a church because his family disapproves, and they will find out. They're in Philadelphia, but they communication and newspapers and everything very quick between Philadelphia and railroad, very quick between Philadelphia and New York. And so finally, before Mrs. Fox and Katie and an unidentified friend, they exchange vows in what would be called a Quaker ceremony. Now, if you know about the Quakers, this becomes a legitimate marriage. However, in this case, there are no civil certificates or registrations. This is just quotes the marriage. And she is thrilled. And several days later, he leaves for Liverpool, England. And he arrives there on October 22nd, 1856. And his plan is, now that he's married her, he's going to support Maggie with the proceeds from his book. His first book was popular, but this one, The Arctic Explorations, is going to be even more popular. He's going to be able to support Maggie on that money and not worry about his family disinheriting him. And there's, you know, a way that they have an intermediary who can, you know, get her letters to him in England and so on, because his family is still watching very carefully. It's just really heartbreaking. And but what happens is he's in England, and if you know about England and 19th century chimney smoke, coal burning fireplaces, and the air is really terribly polluted, and his worsens his rheumatic fever. He finally becomes so ill he cannot go on to do some of the other things he was supposed to do. And the doctors, the royal physicians, hustle him off to a warm, sunny climate, and that turns out to be Cuba. And there are a couple of communications where he writes to her, or she doesn't get most of his, and he doesn't get any, really, almost any of her letters, because the family's always interfering. And he gets to Cuba, and he's almost dying. And a couple of the members somehow get down to Cuba for his last days. And she reads about, before he told her he would leave her something in his legacy if anything happened, because he knew he was terribly ill and his days were numbered anyway. I mean, he always had these scary rheumatic fever attacks, but this one was deadly, this one was fatal. And so he dies, but she doesn't learn about it till she reads about it in the newspaper. So now she's without a way to make a living, and she's technically a widow. There are some very unhappy years that follow. And she still has his letters. She tries to get the family to provide for her through, quotes, his legacy. He left $5,000 in a legacy, but it's not really pinpointed for her, and she tries to prove with the family that she was his wife and she should at least receive dower rights, and they get involved with attorneys, and there's a protracted lawsuit that goes on. Now, the lawsuit takes place in, guess where? Philadelphia, of course, where he's from. And his father had been a district court judge. And the family keeps making these bargains that if she'll give the letters, because they don't want anyone to know he was married to, quotes, the rapper, then they'll provide for her for an annuity out of this $5,000. And there's a struggle that goes on for a long, long time. But ultimately, and somebody else, a neutral party, holds the letters. But she gets a little bit of money, but it's not enough, and it goes, lawsuit goes on. And finally, the lawsuit just, don't believe her. The lawsuit is discounted. She's discounted. She's made to feel ashamed that she's just nothing more than an opportunist and a promoter, and nobody, they don't even know if she really married him, and, you know, is she being another illicit woman here? And finally, she falls into depressions. She also lashes out at them in letters and other behavior, and so she becomes known as a very unstable, emotionally disturbed person, which doesn't help with the lawsuit or her public image. And finally, out of desperation, and it's not until May of 1862 that she finally co-authors with this book with a prominent spiritualist and a journalist. It's called The Love Life of Dr. Cain, in which she publishes the letters and thinks this is going to make her money and also justify and validate her love affair with Dr. Cain. You know, but by then, it's after the Civil War. Actually, it's right sort of in the middle of the Civil War. Nobody really is too involved with this whole spiritual scandal that had gone on beforehand, and she's been forgotten. So basically, there's really no money that's left for her to live on. The family really does never come through with the rest of that settlement.
Do we know what the Fox sisters thought of the Civil War? I mean, it seems pretty clear that this was really what occupied Maggie's attention, but do we have any other kind of indication?
You know, the records, first of all, I should probably have said earlier on, the records on some of this are all, you know, they're obviously contradictory records everywhere, but they're not all that well documented, so we don't have everything that we wish we did to verify it as one would do today. I would assume, given their long history with abolition earlier on in their lives, they would, be in favor of the freeing of the slaves. But I can't tell you that in any definite way. But I do know that the Civil War revived still more interest in spiritualism, because unfortunately there were so many deaths from it that people, again, sought to communicate with their lost loved ones.
You write so beautifully about Maggie's real sense of suffering and loss, and she also starts to drink more and more and more at this time. Can you talk about alcoholism for Maggie and for Kate?
Yeah, let me just say that, let's just back up for a minute, and let's just say, first of all, her father had been an alcoholic, and at one point her parents had separated until he reformed. So there's alcohol in his family, and as we know today, there happens to be a hereditary tendency for this, but that wasn't known then. Also, by the 1830s, along with all of this reform that was going on, there was the beginnings of a real big-time temperance movement. So alcohol is frowned upon by many religious groups and in the public in general, even though it's extremely common. Maggie, in the midst of her breakdowns and so on, after Elisha's death, finally actually becomes a Catholic, which is interesting, but it was something that Elisha had expressed interest in. But, you know, the Catholics do not believe that one should be communing with the dead. In any case, she does become a Catholic. She is drinking more and more. And by the way, her sister, who's become quite a famous and now beautiful, lovely young woman, also is drinking. The two of them are drinking. And there are various efforts to put them on the wagon, so to speak, especially Katie, who, as I say, has become extremely prominent as a medium. And Maggie is at this point still forced to live off her sister and the money that her sister's broken from Leah too, that she's making, and her mother, the money that supports them, is also used to help support Maggie for quite a few years.
Mm. And Katie actually goes into the Swedish Movement Cura Hospital in the 1860s, right? And builds this relationship with the tailors.
Yes, she does. Now, the Swedish is one of those many, and there were many, you know, health reform movements going on at that point, the beginning of the sanitarium movements, or at least the acceleration of them, and water cures and diet cures were very popular in the mid-19th century. You see, things never change, do they? but anyway, yes, so the Swedish movement cure was run by this doctor, George Taylor, and his wife, Sarah, and in New York City. And they care for Katie, and they try to keep her sober and teach her about this. But every time, because she also does seances at the same time. And by the way, her seances continue, in her clairvoyance, and I put that in quotes, continues to be extraordinary. I mean, there are many accounts. And even with the tailors, she's able to call up spirits. But they lovingly monitor her and take care of her. But every time she goes to a party, which they don't allow her to do till she seems to be, you know, having removed the addiction, you know, their dinner parties and seances and whatnot, she is offered wine and she drinks it, and then she's back again. So it's a sort of a ping pong situation for them. But they really adopt her like a daughter and take care of her in a loving way. And eventually, Katie too, Maggie too, Maggie won't go to the tailors, at least initially. She resists it. And she slowly is beginning to go back to spiritualism. Leia, of course. Leia is amazing. Leia is a very bright, opportunistic, dynamic, and charismatic, if tricky, person. And she finally, she marries a very prominent man. You know, this is a later in life thing. His last name is Underhill, and he's wealthy. And he is really trying to help Katie and Maggie. He supports them. He sets them up in an apartment by themselves in West 44th Street, then considered a pretty nice area in Manhattan. And he is funding both Katie's rehab and Maggie's support for quite a long time, even though there's, you know, just really ugly feelings and a rift between Leia and her younger sisters.
And then in the early 1870s, Katie leaves. She goes to London.
Yes, she does.
How is she received there?
She's wildly received because, of course, spiritualism has long since crossed the channel. Actually, since the 1850s, it's become a sensation. There are spirit circles there. There are, by the way, scientists looking into all of this, trying to figure it out. And she's very well received and very popular. And she, too, marries. She marries a man named Henry Jenkins, who was well-to-do. And they seem to have a happy marriage. There are all kinds of things. She has two children. The first one, Ferdinand, the baby, they say is psychic. I mean, they have all these stories about him being able to predict things and quite a bit. And then she has a second child who's named Henry Jr., and she's still drinking, I think. Again, some of this is a little fuzzy in terms of the records. She's still drinking, but it's not terrible, and they seem to be happy. And then suddenly he dies. And then she discovers that his legacy, his money, that he's originally from Germany, I mean, it has to go back there. She's not going to get any money for it. And she comes to the United States and back to New York with her two children. Maggie, meanwhile, is become a spiritualist again because it's the only way she can make a living, and she is good at it. She's become quite popular, and she is moving along with that.
How does Maggie go from re-entering spiritualism to the point in 1888 where she publishes through another writer, she works with another writer to publish this confession saying that her seances are a fraud?
Mm-hmm. Well, I will be quick on it because there's something else I want to say afterwards, but which is important about the impact of spiritualism on psychology. But very quickly, Katie has come back with these children and she's drinking again, and the children are neglected, or at least they're seized by the authorities, and she's accused of being an unfit mother. And Maggie, meanwhile, has gone to England and is doing seances there, and she is extremely upset about Katie, and she decides that she has got to confess. And so even before she comes back to New York, she confessed. She starts to make comments and newspaper articles about how she's going to refute spiritualism. And indeed, she comes back, and there's a few interviews with some New York newspapers that are hyping what she's going to say. And then she and Katie do an interview together. And finally, Maggie says, "I'm going to expose corruption in this spiritualist ulcer." Now, I mean, spiritualism has now become very florid. You know, there are spirit cabinets, there are flowers that fall down during things, there are people who reappear, there's ghostly hands. I mean, the Spiritualist Now Association is very large and all over the country and international, and it's become quite elaborate. Some of them are hoaxes, some of them are, not all. Anyway, October 21st, she appears before 3,000 people in the New York Academy of Music, and she gets up on the stage, she confesses, and she says, "And this is how it happens." And she then hikes up her skirts and shows how she makes these sounds with her feet, with her toes. And, you know, by now there's a National Association of Spiritualists and so on, and they're just outraged. What follows is an enormous controversy that goes on for a long time. And then a year later, because nobody by then, even though she got money for this performance and she's now written a book, actually co-authored this book about spiritualism, but then she refutes it. She refutes her refutation. Long story short, it's kind of sad, but it leaves a lot of questions about her. Towards the end of her life, Katie is dying and does die of alcoholism. Ultimately, Maggie does die, 1892, and there are all kinds of mysterious knocks and sounds. A person who is her nurse, who is not a spiritualist, cannot explain them at the time of her death. Much more to say, but we're going to run out of time. So I only say that the psychologists have become intrigued. This leads into William James, the Harvard psychologist, actually in the philosophy department at Harvard, starts investigating some clairvoyance, and one of them is Lenora Piper. It's never explained. He cannot, and so this starts the whole investigation into what we would call parapsychology today, what we would call looking into bipolar, all kinds of things that happen thereafter that become a lot more complex. So it's a gateway, if you will, into what we know today as modern psychology and understandings about psychiatric states, trance states, and illnesses, and so on. I think that's all pretty familiar to people today, but then was a brand new investigation, and lots of investigations, among them the American Society for Psychical Research, which was bona fide scientists, which was sort of a carryover from the earlier British Society for Psychical Research. And much, much later, the National, 1893, the National Spiritualist Association of Churches, NISAC, was finally recognized as a legitimate religion, and used to be centered in upstate New York, near Casadega. It's now called the Lilydale Assembly. and I've had the privilege to go there and meet with some of the real spiritualists. There's a whole process. It isn't, you can just become a spiritualist and do a seance. There's a whole registration. It's very strict. It's fascinating. I'll just say that one more thing. People have laughed about this. Well, people like Arthur Conan Doyle, here we are, the most rational detective writer. He's a spiritualist. Houdini started out believing in it, and then he got to debunk it as a magician. It just kind of goes on. This leads later, much later, into investigations by people like William McDougall, a Harvard psychology professor, who was the chairman at Duke, and his disciple, Dr. Joseph Banks Ryan, who look into ESP. After World War II, parapsychology labs morphed into the Parapsychology Association, which is now part, by the way, of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. So that's just kind of a quick study, run through on some of the impacts of this spiritualism that started with these two girls and teenage girls in a little farmhouse in Hydesville, New York in 1848.
Hey folks, it's Aaron here. I hope today's interview helped you deepen your understanding of everything involved in the world of spiritualism. But we're not done yet. We have more interviews to share with you, so stick around after this brief sponsor break to hear a preview of next week's interview. Next time on Unobscured.
The kind of spiritualism that a woman like Victoria Woodhull would practice as she traveled around the country was a much more basic kind of, almost like a advice columnist that you might have in a newspaper today. She would set up in a hotel, and she didn't have seances per se. She had one-on-one encounters with people who would come in with maybe physical maladies or problems in their marriage, problems with their children's financial problems, just the basic things that a person would go to a priest or a therapist or a politician, if they so dared, and describe their situation and ask for help. These people knew Victoria wasn't equipped to provide them with actual help, but in many cases, it was enough for just to have someone to listen to what they had to say. And that in itself was empowering both for them and for her. For spiritualists, that kind of conversation, you can imagine after a few years, the experience they would build, and the kind of advice that they could then offer, and how it became very social and very political because they knew so many people were suffering from the same problem.
Unobscured was created by me, Aaron Mankey, and produced by Matt Frederick, Alex Williams, and Josh Thane in partnership with iHeartRadio. Research and writing for this season is all the work of my right-hand man, Carl Nellis, and the brilliant Chad Lawson composed the brand new soundtrack. Learn more about our contributing historians, source material, and links to our other shows over at historyunobscured.com. And until next time, thanks for listening.
Unobscured is a production of iHeartRadio and Aaron Mankey. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.